Today, on The Exam Room.
The belly is a second brain. That is an out there concept, yet we're hearing more and more people say, that's actually true. Is that fair to say?
Actually, it is. And this is not sensationalism. This is not trying to be over the top with the way that we describe things. This is actually completely, technically, the correct way to describe what we call the enteric nervous system. So we have the central nervous system, that's our brain and our spinal cord, and it's made up of all these different nerves, and obviously that's quite important to the way that we work. And then there's the second brain, the enteric nervous system. This is our gut, this is our digestion, this is how we break down our food. And what's interesting and powerful, and the reason why we call it the second brain, is that your gut is capable of functioning completely independently. And that's because it's already pre-programmed through the enteric nervous system or the second brain. So 500 million nerves carpeting your intestine. Chuck, guess how many nerves there are in your spinal cord? There's about 100 million. So what that means, the math, five times more nerves in our gut than we have in our spinal cord. That's crazy.
Welcome to the Exam Room Podcast, brought to you by the Physicians Committee. Hi, I am the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll, raising health IQs coast to coast and around the world in great cities like Peoria, Arizona, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Grande Vitória, Brazil. Wherever you are, we appreciate you helping to make the world a healthier place. This is episode 25 of season 7, number 524 overall. You know, some experts believe that you actually have two brains, the one on top of your head and a second in your belly. And while that may sound like science fiction, it is real life, and our growing understanding of this is having a huge impact on our health. And perhaps Johns Hopkins Medicine sums it up best. They say that the brain in your gut is revolutionizing medicine's understanding of the links between digestion, mood, health, and even the way you think. And so today, we're getting into the second brain, tapping into it with gastroenterologist and two-time New York Times bestselling author, Dr. Will Bolsiewicz. So here's what's on tap. We're getting into the enteric nervous system, explaining that, and how the gut and brain actually communicate, the influence that microbiome has on your mood, IBS and IBD, and how they can disrupt the gut-brain axis, plus your digestive system, cognition, and memory. And stress and anxiety may actually cause constipation and bloating, or is it the other way around? We're going to find out, plus get the best foods to heal the gut, and questions from exam roomies who were able to join us live this week on YouTube and on Facebook. But before we get into all of that, don't forget we have two big live shows that are coming up. First, Saturday night, March 23rd in Toronto at the Enercare Center with Dr. Michael Greger. That is part of the Planted Expo. And then Tuesday night, March 26th in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club with Dr. Neil Barnard, we will present The Power Foods Revolution and celebrate the release of his new book, The Power Foods Diet. And tickets for both shows can be purchased with the links that are in the episode notes right now. More on that after this. Your gut, a second brain, explained with the Pharaoh of Fiber himself, Dr. Will Bolsiewicz. Great to see you, sir.
Great to see you, Chuck. I love those balloons that you had in the beginning of the show there.
All right, man, let's talk about the second brain. Is it actually fair to say that the belly is kind of like a second brain, Dr. B?
Actually, it is. And this is not, this is not sensationalism. This is not trying to be over the top with the way that we describe things. This is actually completely, technically, the correct way to describe what we call the enteric nervous system. So we have the central nervous system, that's our brain and our spinal cord, and it's made up of all these different nerves. And obviously, that's quite important to the way that we work. And then there's the second brain, the enteric nervous system. This is our gut. This is our digestion. This is how we break down our food. And what's interesting and powerful, and the reason why we call it the second brain, is that your gut is capable of functioning completely independently. So in other words, your brain, whether your brain is communicating to your gut, which by the way, it is, but whether your brain is communicating to your gut, not communicating to your gut has the capacity and the ability to operate completely independent of any outside signals. And that's because it's already pre-programmed through the enteric nervous system or the second brain.
Very interesting. You know, and it does, it controls so much stuff. So let's dive a little bit further into the enteric nervous system. Walk us through a little bit deeper just how powerful the ENS is. I mean, you just rattled off some things, but it seems like it is a wicked powerful piece of machinery that we have inside of us.
It is a wicked power piece of machinery because the enteric nervous system is the home for your gut microbiome. 38 trillion microbes that reside within the confines, the friendly confines of the enteric nervous system. But also this is actually the home of your immune system. So 60% of immune cells, 70% of immune cells actually reside within the lining of the walls of our intestine. So now, how does this work? Okay, well, let's kind of zoom out for a moment and then we'll zoom back in. When we zoom out for a moment, what is digestion? What is that? Well, it's actually quite simple. We are taking complex food and we're breaking it down into its constituent pieces. So as it breaks down through the process of digestion, what you're left with is like simple proteins or amino acids, simple fats, carbohydrates that could be fiber, could be more complex, or they could be more simple and be sugar. But basically it's preparing our food so that it's no longer a piece of kale or a tomato. And now it's been broken down into its pieces and it's ready for absorption. Now the body gets access to these nutrients. It goes beyond just carbohydrates and protein and fat. It also includes vitamins and minerals and phytochemicals and polyphenols and all these other things that exist. But this is what the process of digestion is. It's the process of taking our food and breaking it down into pieces that then our body can get access to and incorporate into our being as humans. So, how does it work with the enteric nervous system? Well, there's a number of parts to this. Part of it is chemical. All right, so chemical referring to, for example, enzymes, digestive enzymes that allow us to break down, whether it be carbohydrates, fat, or protein. Also, it is physical. Physical refers to the motility, the movement of our intestines. And movement can come in a series of ways. Now, for everyone who's here right now, you're getting like basically a medical school level lecture on the way that digestion works. And that's because I'm a gastroenterologist and these are the things that I think about all the time. But there's sort of two general types of motility. There's motility that comes in waves, like this, comes in waves. And that is intended to propagate or push things through your intestines because your intestines are about 25 or 30 feet long. So as that wave moves through, that wave is basically pushing things along. Now, by the way, that wave, I can prove to you that this wave exists. If you've ever had abdominal pain that comes in waves, it builds, and then releases. You actually are feeling that wave. That is the wave of motility moving through your body. And that wave of motility is coming into contact with something that it doesn't like. And so it's trying to let you know. And that's why the pain and discomfort builds until it releases. That's the wave of motility. But there's a second way that our motility works and our intestines will actually physically break down our food. And that's more of a grinding process where in essence, a segment of our intestines will actually get into the food and sort of go like this with it. So that's not just pushing things through, that's actually trying to break it apart, right? So basically, if you take these things, digestive enzymes, waves of motility, segmentation where it's breaking down our food, all of this stuff is automated. All of this stuff is automated. Now we can adjust it. We can fine tune it with signals from the brain, but you don't need them. You don't need them. The brain could be completely shut down. And as long as you have blood flow going to the intestines will continue to function.
All right. So then it sounds to me that if somebody were suffering, a matter of fact, if we can pull up Julia's question, it sounds to me, Len, if somebody with IBS or IBD, a motility disorder, they would be kind of having a bad way. So how could a disease like that disrupt what is known as the gut-brain axis?
There are a number of different ways that the presence of irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, or inflammatory bowel disease, which is like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. There's a number of different ways that they can potentially disrupt the gut-brain axis. And by the way, it goes both ways. Okay, so let me explain what that means. So there is a disproportionate prevalence of mood disorders among people that have irritable bowel syndrome and inflammatory bowel disease. You are far more likely to be diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder or major depression if you carry one of these diagnoses, irritable bowel syndrome or inflammatory bowel disease. But by the way, so that is the gut affecting our mood, which we can unpack if you want to, Chuck, in a moment. But it goes the other way too, which is that our brain affects our gut. And we can unpack this one as well if you want to, Chuck. There's a number of ways that our brain will affect the way that our digestive system functions, including our gut microbiome. And there's a reason why. I think that everyone, by the way, you don't need to have IBS or IBD to relate to this. There's a reason why in times of stress, most of us, not all, most of us will manifest it in our gut. The vast majority of people in times of stress, like let's pretend that you're going to give a speech publicly and that provokes anxiety and you're stressed and uncomfortable. All right, that discomfort actually manifests in many cases with bloating, some discomfort. That discomfort can intensify and become quite severe. You may get nausea. All right, these are the ways in that acute setting that stress manifests in the gut, but it's also possible for chronic stress to manifest in the gut with exacerbation and worsening of these types of conditions like irritable bowel syndrome or inflammatory bowel disease. You ask a person with Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, does stress make it worse? 100% they will say yes.
Now, here's an interesting question from Annie, who kind of posed this as the chicken or the egg kind of deal. She's wondering whether stress causes bloating or constipation, or is it the other way around? I think that we're beginning to rethink that because back in the day, correct me if I'm wrong, doctors generally believed that stress and anxiety caused the constipation, caused the bloating. But now it seems to be, as you're indicating, it could be the inverse of that.
It's not either or, it's both. It's what we call the vicious cycle. And this was a concept that was brought forward by my mentor at the University of North Carolina, Dr. Doug Drossman. And which I think, has he been on the show, Chuck? I think he has.
I know he would be a first timer once we get him on. If you want to make the connect, I'm more than happy to welcome him on.
Okay. Well, like he's done a bunch of stuff with Chef AJ and other people, people that I've connected him to. He's a good friend of mine. And and the vicious cycle, I want to think about this for a moment. So imagine that you're a person who deals with chronic digestive health problems. Okay. So maybe this is bloating and constipation, and it's a chronic issue. This is not a one day thing. Here's the way that it works. All right. And I would love to know, go to the chat and tell me if you can relate to this and if you understand. And this is not, by the way, just bloating and constipation. I think this extends to many different digestive health issues. And even beyond digestive health issues, we're talking about chronic health issues. Okay. So you have this chronic problem with bloating and constipation. You wake up in the morning and you say to yourself, you know, just in your mind, your inner monologue, you go, I hope that today is a good day. Because you do. You hope that you're going to have a good day because sometimes you don't have good days. And the problem is that at some point, because this is a chronic health issue, you probably actually notice that there's something going on there. You may start to feel that bloating. You may start to feel constipated. And what happens is that your mind, your cognition, your focus becomes entirely on that. Your mind, whatever you're doing, it goes there. And you become fixated on, oh gosh, that bloating is starting. Oh gosh, I'm starting to feel constipated. Gosh, this is not going well. Okay, what's happening in your body in that moment, you may not realize it, is that you're actually activating the sympathetic nervous system because that focus on what's happening in your gut is affecting your mind, affecting your brain. You're activating your sympathetic nervous system. And that sympathetic nervous system, that is your fight or flight part of your nervous system. It releases epinephrine. it raises your blood pressure, it raises your heart rate, it intensifies your focus. And the problem is that your focus is what's happening here. That intensity of focus actually intensifies the sensitivity of the nerves within your gut. So whatever it is that you were feeling, it actually is turning into something bigger. Not because anything changed inside your gut, but instead what changed is the way that you are receiving that information from your gut. You are more focused on it, and those nerves are now more sensitive. And so you actually feel an intensification of your symptoms. And that intensification of the symptoms actually creates more stress, more anxiety. Gosh, this is getting worse. And we round and round the vicious cycle we go. This is the vicious cycle of chronic health issues. People, and this is, by the way, Chuck, not a choice. This is not a choice. This is not conscious. And it is inherent in being human. Because we wish that we weren't this way. We wish we could just let it go. But I can't think of anyone who was like a CIA agent that was able to train their sympathetic nervous system. I never had a patient that was a CIA agent that could train their sympathetic nervous system not to activate and fire when they're feeling stressed or when they're feeling this type of thing. So this is the way that it works, Chuck. These things are intertwined. I hope I made that clear.
And I'm curious about the sensitivity of the nerves that you were talking about. Suppose that somebody is a chronic sufferer of a disease, especially when they're trying to figure it out. And they've been to 18 billion doctors. They think it's pretty clear that it's going to be some sort of a GI issue. They still haven't been able to nail it down. Do those nerves, because they're so irritated, do they become even more irritated over time? And then that ratchets up the depression, the anxiety, the panic attacks that I've heard from some patients with this.
Yeah. So if you take those nerves, all right. So by the way, I should have mentioned this when we were doing an introduction to the enteric nervous system. Your gut is completely carpeted with nerves. There's not a millimeter where there aren't nerves present within your gut. They're everywhere. And if we think about like the density of nerves within the gut, let's put numbers to this. There are 500 million nerves carpeting the 25 to 30 feet of intestine. All right. So you think about an individual foot could have hundreds of thousands of nerves. All right. So 500 million nerves carpeting your intestine. Chuck, guess how many nerves there are in your spinal cord, which is part of your central nervous system?
I'm guessing less than 500 million.
Yeah, I set you up for that one. Thank you. That's a great and intelligent answer. You must have been good at multiple choice tests back in the day. So if I were a nasty professor, I would have tried to make it harder for you. There's about 100 million. So what that means, the math, five times more nerves in our gut than we have in our spinal cord. That's crazy. There's more nerves in our brain than there are in our gut, but our gut is actually the second most densely packed area of our entire body in terms of those nerves. So the question that you asked me, Chuck, is like, do they get more sensitive? Do they get more sensitive when you deal with this on a chronic basis? The answer is an absolute and resounding yes. And this is, there's two facets to this issue. So when we think about the gut and or nerves in general, we assume that the stimulus is the only thing that matters, right? That the only thing that could change in the way that I perceive touching my finger is how hard I touch my finger. But actually, that's not true. The sensitivity of the nerves could change. And we're not used to it happening with our finger unless you have some sort of thing that's dulling the nerves. For example, people that have diabetes can develop neuropathy and may feel dullness of the nerve. So that is where the nerve is actually changing. In the gut, it is constantly changing. It is constantly changing. And irritable bowel syndrome, the modern 2024 understanding of this condition, which is radically different than what I learned when I was being trained as a gastroenterologist, is that this is a disorder of the brain-gut axis. All right, this is not just a digestive disorder. Now we've expanded the view to say it's not just the gut. It's the gut and the brain. So if we're going to address this issue, don't just treat the gut. Don't just treat the gut. Treat the gut and the brain. It's like the sound on a stereo system, Chuck, okay, with these nerves. If you have a throbbing headache and someone is blasting music, what are you going to do? the answer is you're going to turn the dial down on that music. And the same is true with these nerves. When those nerves are hypersensitive, responding to things that they shouldn't even respond to, right? The stimulus is the same. The stimulus hasn't changed. They're the thing that's changed. They're a lot more sensitive. When they're being like that, we just got to turn them down. If we could turn them down, then you get much more comfortable. And that's what we can try to do as one of our strategies.
All right. Before we get to the next question, I want to say hi to Monica and to Lee, who are joining us right now from Lubbock, Texas. Monica says that this is her first time watching live and she is your biggest fan, Dr. B.
What's up, Monica? Love you back.
Want to say hi to Wendell, who's joining us in Boonesboro, Maryland. Yakira, who's in Alabama. Philip in Indianapolis. Shamdai, who's in South Africa. Emmeline in Houston. Tamara in California having breakfast with us, as is Lori. So many great people. Tofu Tuesday, our longtime exam roomie favorite. She's in Phoenix as well. Kathy in Connecticut. Man, just all over today.
We got friends in low places, Chuck. It's a good thing.
Low places, high places, you know, longitude, latitude. Too. We look at
Let's get some Garth going.
Yeah.
Not Garth Davis. Sorry, Garth.
Garth, that's another great guy, man.
I love Garth Davis. Davis.
All right, let's switch gears really quickly before we take one of these amazing questions that are sitting in the mailbag. Peter got to us ahead of time. And Peter was wondering how the digestive tract can impact memory and cognition. We've talked a lot about mood here, but not so much about memory and cognition. So what is the connection there, Dr. B?
Yeah, there's a quite powerful connection between our gut and energy levels, which it defies, I guess what I would say is not well understood by traditional allopathic medicine. What is energy? Yet every single one of you who are here listening to us live, if I were to ask you to go to the chat and talk to me about how you're feeling in terms of energy on a scale of 0 to 10, you could do that. Because you know exactly what the answer is. It's just that medicine struggles to understand what is energy. Energy, memory, cognition, to me, we're kind of talking about things that exist in a similar conceptual framework, which is they're a little bit difficult to define, yet we all know that they're there and we all feel them in a certain way. And the gut is playing a central role in each of these things. And so now when it comes to energy, I think like there's two main factors that I think about, which is the gut barrier being intact, all right, and the immune system. Because when we're activating the immune system, we're creating inflammation. And if you look consistently in studies where they ask people, how do you feel? What are your energy levels? Energy levels dip when people have a chronic inflammatory issue consistently. So I think that there's a strong tie between inflammation and energy. In terms of memory and cognition, that inflammatory tie continues to exist, but there's other elements to this. And really it speaks to, Chuck, the way in which our gut communicates to our brain, which happens in many different ways. One is the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve connects our brain to our gut. But there's also ways signaling molecules that our gut can release, which can affect these things. Let me give you a quick example. You go to the beach, it's a beautiful day. You get some extra sunshine. How do you feel, ignoring the sunburn that's gonna be coming tomorrow? How do you feel? I'll tell you how I feel when I go to the beach and have a great day. I feel very relaxed, but I also get this almost Zen-like focus that exists, okay? What's happening there? Actually, the sun exposure is activating the release of serotonin within your gut. 95% of serotonin is produced in your gut, not in your brain. Serotonin is the happy hormone, but also affects our energy levels. It affects our ability to focus. Okay, serotonin does all these things. Now, I want to be totally clear because I'm quite sure any second now there's going to be someone that jumps into the chat and says, yes, but Dr. B, you're wrong because. Okay, let me say what you're going to say. So the serotonin produced by the gut, we're not totally clear that it crosses the blood-brain barrier. So when I say 95% of serotonin and that your gut can affect your mood, it's not necessarily that the serotonin produced in your gut does actually cross into your brain. But what we do know, though, with clarity is that there are precursor molecules called 5-HT3 that are produced, this is the nerdy thing, that are produced in the gut that do cross the blood-brain barrier and can be turned into serotonin in the brain. And what we also know with clarity is that gut microbiome is associated with our mood. And we also know with clarity is that food is connected to both of these things. You can affect your gut microbiome with food, and you can also affect your mood with food. And that's a powerful and an interesting concept.
All right. And that is a great segue here to a question that we have from Melinda. Came in at 11:54. She was just waiting to pounce here. Wondering about the link between fatty food specifically and mood swings. So what do we know about fat here and mood and how that affects everything we've been talking about here today?
Well, I think that the big thing from my perspective to vilify an entire macronutrient would be inappropriate. Because there are healthy forms of fat, and healthy forms of fat, people clearly live longer with less disease when they preferentially steer themselves towards healthy forms of fat. So really, this is a question of dietary quality, because there's good fat, there's bad fat, there's good protein, there's bad protein, there's good carbs, and there's bad carbs. And what we want is to build and construct a diet that is made up of as much of the good stuff as we can reasonably get without driving ourselves insane and becoming perfectionist, which actually becomes sort of not helpful in our process. So fat specifically, from my perspective, it's not so much fat and mood swings. It's more so dietary quality and mood swings. And the fact that in the United States, as we speak, the most unhealthy forms of fat tend to dominate in the average American's diet. And so when you look at fat sort of globally within the United States, what you will discover is you'll say, oh, well, fat generally is not super good for people. But you would say the same thing, unfortunately, about carbohydrates, because people are eating a lot of refined, ultra-processed carbohydrate sources. It comes back to dietary quality. Let's build a healthy diet that includes healthy fats, proteins, and carbohydrates.
Sure. A burger and fries is, you're going to get not that high quality fat you're talking about as you would from, say, an avocado. Night and day difference. Same thing about a carbohydrate that you would find in a bean or, say, rice versus something that you would get at a Hostess donut. So completely different kind of thing, correct?
Correct. Shout out to Hostess.
Let's not forget little Debbie can't leave her in the corner by herself either. I want to say hi to Adam, who says that this is his first time watching live. Been 3 years. He's in Pershore, UK. Also, Dr. Yvonne Kimmel, who's watching in Dallas. Catherine in Santa Fe. Barb checking in from the Sunshine State in Florida. Donna in Tokyo. Natalie in Houston. So good, Stephanie in Pennsylvania. So many people all over
global,
the world.
Global. Lovely people, too. Lovely people.
I'm a big fan of the people. All right. Let's take a question here. Man, do you want a next level question? Do you want to take it up a notch?
Yeah, hit me, come at me.
All right, Darren at 1218, any kind of functional taxonomies of microbiome bacteria, including byproduct production and relation with other bacteria? That's from Darren at 1218. Have fun with that.
Related to mood?
Did not specify.
Okay, let's take, because we've been kind of talking about mood and we've been talking about the gut-brain axis. So, I love when science converges on consistently on the same discovery, the same idea. I love it. Because to me, no one finding or study by itself is adequate to really prove a point. What we want is we want to see consistency across multiple studies, across multiple types of studies. And what's amazing and beautiful and exciting about fiber is that we keep coming back to this and short-chain fatty acids and the power that they hold in terms of not just our gut health, but in terms of our cognition and our brain health. And so it's quite fascinating to consider, Chuck, that they've done these microbiome studies looking at the microbiome of people who have mood disorders, diagnosable mood disorders, not just like, hey, I'm having a bad day. We're talking about people with major depression or generalized anxiety disorder. And particularly with major depression, you will discover that there are clear changes in the microbiome that exist they're consistent with dysbiosis? And what are the microbes that are missing in major depression? If you start to look at them, what is the same and consistent across them is the absence or the loss of the microbes that produce short-chain fatty acids. And that is because we believe there is an inflammatory element to mood disorders that perhaps is initiated in the gut, where an inadequate supply of short-chain fatty acids has downstream effects throughout our entire body, including on our brain, including on our mood. And one last thing I want to just throw in here real quick, because it's more a topic of interest that fascinates me. Our gut, people hear me, I've already talked about it on the show. Our gut has a gut barrier, all right? And I go like this, because if you were looking at it without a microscope, this is what it would look like, which means invisible. You wouldn't be able to see it, but it would be a fine little line, less than a fraction of a hair off your head. That is the gut barrier that separates the tube of our intestine, where 38 trillion microbes live, from the other side, where 70% of our immune system resides. And this single layer of cells is held together by these proteins called tight junctions. And it turns out the short chain fatty acids are what repair tight junctions so that we can restore the integrity of this gut barrier to protect ourselves. This is our wall that defends the castle. Okay, so if you had a castle, there would be the outer wall, right? And we want that to be strong, basically to protect the citizens within this within the castle. But there would also be the inner wall, right? If anyone who's watched Game of Thrones, you know there's like the inner tower where the most precious commodity, the most important things, including the king and the queen, this is where you put them, right? So that if the outer wall breaks, at least you got the inner wall to protect you. This is the blood-brain barrier. The blood-brain barrier protects our most precious commodity, our brain. The blood-brain barrier is made the exact same way, the exact same building blocks, and the exact same proteins as the gut barrier, which means tight junctions and a single layer of cells. And if you wanted to restore the gut barrier, guess what does it? Short-chain fatty acids. Short-chain fatty acids repair the tight junctions. So when people, Chuck, by the way, talk about brain fog, and brain fog is this thing that, again, allopathic medicine, Western medicine, struggles with, not because we're bad people, us medical doctors, we're not bad people, we want to help you, but we struggle with things that we don't have the ability to objectively define with blood work or with a CAT scan. It sucks. This is the way it is. But anyone who's experienced brain fog knows, they know that this is real and your brain feels cloudy and like disorganized and it's hard to focus. And this, to me, brain fog, this is leaky brain. This is breakdown of the blood-brain barrier. And if we could restore, and that could be due to chronic inflammatory issues, and if we could restore that blood-brain barrier, perhaps with short-chain fatty acids, then we can protect the brain once again. So I hope that helps.
So give me some examples. Give us some examples of foods that we might want to incorporate into our diet that would help us build these short-chain fatty acids back up.
Well, I'm going to go with two broad categories, and I don't think they will surprise you or any of my other fans who are out there, because you've heard me say this. And the reason why I keep saying this like a broken record is because it's true. And this is where science is at. First is plants, fiber-rich foods. And all plants contain fiber, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, seeds, nuts, and legumes. And it's to our benefit to not just consume fiber and not just focus on grams, but to focus on variety. As many different varieties of plants as you can incorporate reasonably into your diet, that's the strategy. That's what we want to do. So fiber-rich foods consumed in variety, that's number one. Number two is fermented foods. Now, there's many different types of fermented foods. And there was an interesting study that struck you and I, because every time I'm on the show, you're on the show too with me, buddy. So you've heard me many times refer to the study out of Stanford University, where they showed that through 8 weeks of consumption of fermented food, they could actually increase the diversity within the microbiome and also reduce measures of inflammation. You're affecting both. You're affecting both sides. You're affecting the gut and the immune system. All right. So fermented foods is one of the strategies that we can have to do this. But if you want short-chain fatty acids from those fermented foods, those fermented foods need to be embedded with a special nutrient that you guys know I love, which is fiber. So the plant-based fermented foods, that's where the money is at. Work that into your diet.
Yeah, man. And all of that, though, becomes really tricky if somebody's being treated for something like SIBO or IBS or IBD, low FODMAP diet a lot of times. And it feels like that can be a little bit restrictive. And some of the things that you would find in fermented foods, say one of the things that I really love is kimchi. I can't imagine that somebody who is eating a really restricted diet like that would be able to incorporate that easily. So what advice would you have for somebody that's already in the battle?
Well, I think it's important to understand, Chuck, that with SIBO, there is, so it's common practice with SIBO to do two things with people: give them antibiotics and reduce their fiber intake. And I understand why. When you take the antibiotic, at least on a temporary basis, many times you feel better because you're suppressing the bacteria. So that at least temporary suppression of bacteria makes you feel better. So you think that that's, it makes sense. Like, I felt better on the antibiotic and I felt better off the, I felt worse off the antibiotic. Therefore, I should be on the antibiotic. I get the logic. The problem is that it's short-term gain and long-term loss because antibiotics induce dysbiosis, which means a disbalance, an imbalance and damage to the gut microbiome. SIBO is dysbiosis. We're making it worse through repeated use of antibiotics. This is not, by the way, to say that there's no role for antibiotics and we should be antibiotic free. This is to say that a strategy that relies on repeated courses of antibiotics is potentially harmful. And we need to rethink that strategy. How can we rethink it? We need to rebuild the microbiome. The way that we rebuild the microbiome is by fueling these microbes. And this is where fiber comes into play. And in SIBO studies, Chuck, they've actually demonstrated that although people want to skip the fiber because they say it makes me feel unwell, I want to unpack that in a second. But before I unpack that, let me start with the research that says that fiber is an essential part of rebuilding your gut microbiome. And in these SIBO studies, people who increase their fiber intake recover from their SIBO as opposed to the people who do not. Fiber becomes an important part of the story. Now, I am not saying, going back to, I promised I would get to this, going back to you don't feel well when you eat fiber, I'm not saying that you should just be miserable. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that we need strategies to get fiber on board and reduce the misery, make you more comfortable. A low FODMAP diet can be a way to do this, but you don't want to go low FODMAP and stay low FODMAP, and you don't want to be so simple as to just do low FODMAP. You want low FODMAP with fiber. And that's possible. There are low FODMAP foods, an example is raspberry, which are high in fiber. Another thing that I'll just throw out there, Chuck, because this just feels like it fits so perfectly into this conversation, is that this is a place where supplements can be helpful. So as an example, 38 Terra, our new supplement, Daily Microbiome Nutrition, was designed specifically to be low FODMAP and to deliver the fiber and the resistance starches that you need to actually fuel the healing that you're looking for within your gut microbiome. This is not an argument of supplements instead of food. That is not what I'm saying, just to be totally clear. This is an argument that we should take the food as far as we can take it, but for people who are sick, there's limits to how far they can take it. And supplements can add benefit. Whether you are sick or not sick, supplements can add benefit. To me, I'm about results, and results come from making the right choices that lead to beneficial outcomes. And so to me, it's the best of both. Optimize your diet and, when appropriate, add a supplement. And to me, a low FODMAP fiber supplement makes a lot of sense in a person with SIBO who's struggling with these issues.
Now, I don't want to turn this into a commercial. I will tell you that up front, but I am a fan of 38T, and I'm curious for somebody who might be in that situation, would that be potentially a good option for them to get a little bit of extra fiber there?
It can be a good option. But the other thing, whether it's 38 Terra or it's a different fiber supplement, regardless of what you choose to do, I think that there's a place where this is helpful. I, by the way, would not do inulin, which is like sort of the common thing that's out there. It's in like the, you know, the sodas where they have high fiber soda. No, don't do that. That's a disaster waiting to happen. All right. You want low FODMAP. And whether it's 38 Terra or a different low FODMAP fiber source, The other thing to be aware of is you may still need to start low and go slow, even though it's low FODMAP.
Elizabeth is joining us. She seems to be a little bit perplexed by what it is we're talking about here. So Elizabeth is wondering, one, what is a FODMAP? What is low FODMAP? And two, could you just briefly explain what SIBO is? If you could do that in, I'd say a minute or less, that would be great.
Okay, cool. Yeah, let me try to be even less than that, Chuck. I like the challenge. SIBO is an acronym. It stands for small intestine bacterial overgrowth. Basically, these are people that have an excessive growth of bacteria within their small intestine, which is not where they're supposed to be. And when that happens, it can be very disruptive to the way that our intestines work and function. Microbes are active. Microbes do things. And when you insert a whole bunch of microbes into the small intestine where they're not supposed to be, their activity and the things that they're doing actually are out of balance, and it makes people feel unwell. So with SIBO, we're talking about a low FODMAP diet. FODMAPs is another acronym, fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. I've said this so many times that I don't even think about it anymore, but I'm still proud of myself for getting through that. We're talking about fructose and fruit, lactose and dairy products. We're talking about the galactans, which are complex polysaccharides found in beans, or fructans, which you'll find in gluten-containing grains like wheat, or in onions, garlic. And we're also talking about polyols, which are sugar alcohols, could be artificial sweeteners, could also be things that you find in, like, for example, watermelon. So now all of these things, what ties them together is they're all fermentable, meaning they can cause bloating. The concept of a low FODMAP diet is that you reduce these things temporarily, you reduce these things that are fermentable that can cause bloating and discomfort. All right, so it's just a way of starting low and going slow. And it was a big chapter in my Fiberfield cookbook. So those of you who are interested in this topic, that's a place that you can learn more about that.
All right. And we'll wrap this up with Jamie. I want to end on kind of a high note. Jamie apparently may have been suffering for a while and is wondering whether a bad diet can permanently damage the gut. At what point is there, the point of no return, so to speak?
The only place that I've seen the point of no return, Chuck, is with aggressive antibiotic use. It's the only place I've seen the point of no return. I have not seen the point of no return with diet. It can create, the hole can get deeper, and climbing out of that hole can require more time and consistency. For example, inflammatory bowel disease. But I tend to take an optimistic view of this because I sit before you today as this representative of better eating, not perfect eating, but better eating. I changed my own diet. I restored my own health. I fixed health-related issues through diet. But actually, the majority of my life, 75% of my life, I got by on a trash diet. So if I can get to this place, maybe in 10 years, you who are listening to me today, you'll be the one on the microphone and I'll be learning from you.
I love that so much. All right, let's wrap up by talking a little bit more about 30AT. We have a couple of people who are wondering what the status of that is, because you were talking about the big benefits there, but there was also big demand. So what is the status of 38 Terra at the moment?
Yeah, I sent an email out to anyone who's in my community to kind of talk about this, because I think that, like, sometimes communication helps to create better understanding of what's going on. There's people who want it, and unfortunately, the reality is, like, in the moment, it's not very easy for me to give it because we have more demand than we have supply. Now, in Australia, or if you live on that side of the world, guess what? You can get access to 38 Terra. It's available through the Australian store. In the United States, Canada, the UK, it's more challenging. We're working on it. There is a wait list. All you have to do is email 38terra at support.com. I'm sorry, support at 38terra.com. If you email them, if you want to be on the wait list, there's no obligation to be on the wait list. But it does get you in line for 38terra. And then our next launch, Chuck, is March 27th at 12 noon. So you can mark your calendar March 27th at 12 noon. I can assure you, if you show up at 12 noon, you will be able to get your hands on some 38 Terra if you live in the United States. So, and we're working on this. We placed an order months ago to to get more. It just takes time. And I don't want to spend 2 minutes unpacking why. It has to do with manufacturing and shipping and stuff like that.
But. Yeah, we don't have to get into that, the ins and outs. So March 27th, you say, at noon. That's 2 weeks from this very date as we're doing the live show. So set a reminder, everybody, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. And hey, tune into the exam room while you're doing it. There you go. What else do you have cooking? Any courses firing up at your website, man? I want to make sure, because you gave us so much time and information today. I want to make sure that people who are interested in continuing to learn still get that opportunity. What's cooking over at your website right now?
I want to take a quick moment to talk about something I'm very excited about that's happening with Zoe. So for those of you who are familiar, Zoe is the personalized nutrition program that I've been working with. I was initially on their scientific advisory board, and then I am their US medical director, and I've been doing this for a few years now. And what I am really excited about is that we had the audacity to put it all on the line. There's a lot of products out there, actually the majority of products out there, they never actually prove that they do anything. They just sell. And marketing is powerful. And if you market, you can get what you want typically from a commercial perspective. But is that honest? So Zoe, what we did is a clinical trial. It's a randomized control trial. And we didn't compare Zoe to eating sugar or eating croutons. We compared Zoe to people actually following USDA recommended guidelines, which if you look at them, are they perfect? Would I sign off on them? No. Are they bad and horrible and like completely wrong? No, they're not. They're like 85%, 90% of the way there. They just need some tweaking. So we compared people on Zoe to the USDA dietary plan, and I'm happy to report that if you look at all people who use the Zoe program, they lost more centimeters off their waist circumference. They lost more weight. They had lower triglycerides. They had an improved gut microbiome. They had improvements of mood, energy, appetite, and sleep. All of these things happened on all, like if you look at the entire population of people that were on the Zoe program. But if you drill down and you say, well, what about the people who are actually doing it? Because some people don't. Some people just continue doing what they're currently doing, even though they're in a clinical trial. So if you look at the people who actually adhere to Zoe, they got even more benefits. Everything that I just described, they got more of that, but they also lowered their LDL cholesterol, lowered their ApoB. By the way, these are very powerful cardiovascular risk factors. They improved their insulin sensitivity. These weren't even people with diabetes. So all that exists. But then what we come back to is then why would you do Zoe though if you could just do the USDA guidelines? Why not just do the USDA guidelines? And so what we looked at is people that were rigidly adherent to Zoe versus people that were rigidly adherent to USDA guidelines. So both groups are actually doing what we're asking them to do. And what we discovered in that head-to-head comparison is that Zoe dominated. People got clearly superior health benefits by following Zoe compared to actually following the USDA guidelines. Zoe is the superior choice. So the reason why I want to bring this up, Chuck, is that I'm proud of it. I'm proud of it. I'm a co-author on a paper that's going to be published in Nature Medicine coming up, which, by the way, that's like getting an Oscar. It's Oscars week. That's like getting an Oscar in science. All right. So I'm proud of this, but I'm also proud to be a part of this company that had the audacity to put it on the line and see what actually happens and then report to you with transparency what we actually did. And in the study, the product was like a 2022 product. It's 2024. Zoe keeps getting better. So we have an even better today. If you want to learn more about this, go to joinzoe.com/Dr. Wilby. Wilby, W-I-L-B.
And we'll get a link to that in the show description or in the episode notes for you. And I want to wrap up with a nice comment from Catherine. This one came in at 12:31. She said, speaking of what it was we were talking about earlier in terms of the gut-brain access and the connection there, the mind, the belly, all of that, she said, look, I am a psychiatrist and I love Dr. B's work. Thank you so much for Fiber Fueled. So helpful and fascinating. And so I just think that speaks volumes to get that type of endorsement from a psychiatrist who specializes in helping people with the mind. I think that that's fantastic and really lends a ton of credibility to everything that we've been talking about today.
No, that's amazing. I love it. I mean, I have I hope that this is clear. I have such tremendous respect and admiration for all healthcare providers, because I know what we're trying to do and I know how hard and challenging it can be at times, having been there myself. And I'm grateful particularly for the healthcare providers that are willing to be a maverick. And what I mean by that is not being crazy or a cowboy. I mean, like, they don't care that the system is trying to stop them from talking about diet and lifestyle. And they're a maverick because they think that this is so important that they will deliver that to their patients no matter what the system says. And those people are my favorite.
Hear, hear for the rebels, my friend, the mavericks, as you like to call them. You, sir, are definitely a maverick, and that's why we appreciate your time, my friend. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Chuck. Thanks, everyone. Love seeing y'all.
Man, that was a fun show today, wasn't it? There are links for you to connect to Dr. B in the episode notes. You can sign up, get on the waiting list for 38T, or take any one of his amazing courses on his website. Love it when he's on the show. He'll be back again next month, so let's just count down the days together. But man, pretty wild stuff today. Having a second brain, your gut. I mean, it controls nerves, digestion, depression, constipation, memory, mood, all of it, and a lot more. And we're going to learn more in the coming years, too. We're talking about powerful, powerful discoveries that are being made that are going to revolutionize medicine. So truly an awesome, awesome show. And since we had the author of Fiber Fueled on the show today, I thought it appropriate to mention this study on the effect that fiber has on rheumatoid arthritis. This is pretty fascinating. Researchers found out that cereal fiber appears to be particularly beneficial in fighting RA, according to findings that were published in the journal Nature Scientific. And it is here that they conclude that individuals with higher cereal fiber intake are less likely to develop the disease, and that the dietary inflammatory index score, which cereal fiber scored very well on, is a crucial intermediary in this battle. Now, other fibrous foods like fruits and vegetables were also examined, but the relationship between fiber found in cereal appears to be particularly potent here. But they say more research is needed in the future to further explore this relationship. So stay tuned. More exciting nutrition research still to come. That's pretty wild, right? Cereal fiber. I would have thought that another form of fiber might score highest here, but not in this case. Hey, don't forget to join us in person in Washington, D.C. on March 26th at the National Press Club. We are doing a very special episode of the Exam Room podcast with Dr. Neil Barnard plus Chef Dustin Harder and Stephanie Ignafo. And this is also the date, March 26th, that Dr. Barnard's new book, The Power Foods Diet, comes out. So we're having a big old party to celebrate and taping an episode of the show. And everyone who joins us at the National Press Club that night will get their own copy of Dr. Barnard's new book. And you just can't beat a deal like that. Tickets are on sale right now at pcrm.org/events, or click the link in the episode notes. Or if you're north of the border, our friends in Canada can join me Saturday night, March 23rd at the Enercare Center in Toronto. I'm going to be sitting down with Dr. Michael Greger to talk about unlocking longevity and his book, How Not to Age. Plus, I'll be sticking around the next day and speaking at the Planted Expo. So a big weekend ahead in Toronto, and you can visit plantedlife.com for ticket information, or again, click the link in the episode notes. And one more link to click, and that is over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is that you get your shows. If you haven't already followed or subscribed to the Exam Room Podcast by the Physicians Committee, go ahead and do that. And when you do that, please also leave a 5-star rating and a nice review. Tell us how the podcast has helped to raise your health IQ, or how a plant-based diet has helped to improve your health, because every 5-star rating, new review helps get this information to people who are still searching for answers, still looking to improve their health, and you can help them find it just by taking the time to leave that 5-star rating and nice review. And for today, That, my friend, is going to wrap things up. I want to say thank you one more time to our good friend, Dr. Will Bulsiewicz, for being here, inspiring us and raising our health IQs in a major way as we tapped into the second brain. And for everyone at the Physicians Committee, I am the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll. Thank you so very much for listening. And remember, as always, keep it plant-based.